Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, December 7th. With cases, hospitalizations, and deaths spiking nationwide now, more and more drastic shutdown measures are coming to more and more places as maybe our only recourse until the vaccines really get out there. Here is Berkeley, California public health officer Dr. Lisa Hernandez over the weekend.
Until we get through this wave, you should not meet in person with anyone you do not live with, even in a small group, and even outdoors with precautions. If you have a social bubble, it is now popped.
So, America, are we ready to pop our social bubbles for a while to prevent the worst of the worst? Do restaurants and other small businesses really have to close, or can they stay open with social distancing? And are we ready to equitably distribute and to be willing to take the COVID vaccines? Will Joe Biden's nominees for Health and Human Services Secretary and CDC Director make a difference? If you haven't heard, he's reportedly nominating California Attorney General and former Congressman Javier Becerra for HHS and Rochelle Walensky, Chief of the Infectious Disease Department at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and a Harvard Med School professor, to revive the Centers for Disease Control, which has been so marginalized by President Trump. And then there's Rudy Giuliani and apparently three state legislatures he's exposed before being diagnosed with COVID yesterday. Lawmakers in Michigan, Georgia, and Arizona. Lots of Rudy hugs and loud droplet spreading, rooting, talking. Hardly ever a Rudy mask. With me now, Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, epidemiology and global health professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. She is also director of their center known as ICAP, leading the design, implementation, scale-up, and evaluation of large-scale HIV and other public health programs in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia. Dr. El-Sadr has also been a MacArthur Genius Grant winner for some of that global health work. It's great to have you again. Welcome back to WNYC, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
So many places we could start. But how about that clip from Dr. Hernandez from Berkeley Public Health? The hardest hit parts of California are going for serious stay-at-home orders again as of today. Is it necessary, in your opinion?
I do believe it's necessary. As has been mentioned before, and as we're all aware of, the situation is quite alarming in the United States and almost every part of this country in terms of the large numbers of cases and hospitalizations and deaths. This poses a huge individual health threat, but also as well threat to the health system itself. And there's some areas where there's the risk of overwhelming hospitals and intensive care units and so on. So it's time to act. And I think that is the reason why in Berkeley they're moving ahead with these kinds of interventions now, to say we have to do what we know works. And that means that we have to limit the exposure to other people as much as we can until we can get over this crisis. I think the time is now to do whatever can be done to limit contact between people so that we can stop transmission of this virus.
To limit contact between people. It sounds so draconian when we put it that way. I know we were there in the New York area and California too, in a more preventive way. Mm-hmm. In the spring, New York, in reaction to how widely the virus spread there. And on the other side of the country from Berkeley, Staten Island, maybe known as a pro-police, so-called law and order borough of New York City. Being pro-police and law and order was a big reason they just replaced Democrat Max Rose with Republican Nicole Malliotakis for Congress. But the big story out of Staten Island this weekend was the anti-police rhetoric and alleged anti-police violence by a bar owner who was repeatedly breaking COVID safety laws and then allegedly drove his car into a sheriff's deputy trying to serve him a summons, breaking multiple bones on the sheriff's body, we are told. Now, that's one allegedly violent criminal miscreant, but there are many otherwise law-abiding small business owners who think they can stay open, have social distancing and mask policies, and not spread the virus, but still be able to make a living. My question for you, Dr. El-Sadr, is does the data suggest yes or no? Is there good data on this? Can businesses open with real social distancing policies, limiting capacity in their stores or restaurants, with mask policies, and not spread the virus? Or do we know that's how the virus is spreading to some degree?
Well, I think it depends. I always think it depends on the type of business. I think it's particularly alarming if you, for bars and restaurants to, for example, have indoor dining or indoor, congregation in bars, for example, because those are settings where people are close together and also where people remove their masks. So that's particularly dangerous kinds of environments. I think it's very different from a situation where people are going for necessities, like, for example, going to get food shopping and so on, where I believe that with the limitations on density and keeping the numbers of people who can enter into a supermarket to the appropriate level, as well as with the physical distancing and the masking, I think those are situations where that can be done more safely. So I think it's the manner, it's not just the any business, it's the type of business, how essential is that business, and also the fact that there are some situations where just by the nature of the activities that are going on, that people do remove their masks for prolonged periods of time, and that's what we know allows for transmission of this virus.
For you who have worked so much on Africa and Asia with respect to HIV in the past, why do you think the United States and Western Europe have been hit so much harder than Africa in particular? It's not in the news very much, and I feel like our listeners know more about the difference between here in Asia, I think, and correct me if you think I'm wrong, but that in Asia there were more strict lockdown policies at first, at the beginning. They had more experience there with SARS and other past infectious diseases that are similar to COVID, so they did the real isolation and contact tracing there in ways we didn't in the United States. But what about Africa? How do you explain Africa with its relatively low rates compared to Europe and Asia? I mean, Europe and the United States.
Yeah, I think this has been an enigma, and there are several possibilities or several hypotheses that we believe may play a role in why African countries have not been as hit as hard as the United States or European countries. Firstly, is the pandemic came to them later than it did to Europe and the United States. So I think in many ways that this allowed the leadership and the public health leadership, as well as the political leadership in those countries, to be poised to be better prepared than we were. So I think just the timing in and of itself may have helped these African countries. I think another factor is they actually, many of these countries moved very quickly to put in place quite strong, what we call mitigation control measures. So they went very quickly to, for example, putting in place the limitations in terms of travel, domestic travel, international travel. They rapidly also closed schools and universities. They also issued the stay-at-home directives as well. So there was a rapid movement to putting in some of these strict measures. I think for the United States, for some European countries, we did it more incrementally. So that's the second factor. And the third factor is the population is very different. The population in many African countries is much younger than the average population age in several European countries, as well as in the United States. And we know that, of course, COVID-19, just getting infected at an older age is associated with much more likelihood of getting sick, and unfortunately also the likelihood of dying from COVID-19. Keep in mind that we now know that 40% of the death from COVID-19 in this country occurred, unfortunately, amongst nursing home residents. So I think because of these kind of the actions that these leaders did and did very promptly, I think because of some of the public health measures that were put in place. And lastly, probably as well because of just the population distribution and the younger population in African countries, that may also have helped as well. I think we should also be cautious because many of the countries in Africa still don't have sufficient supply of testing, for example. So it's possible that we're missing a lot of cases of COVID-19, particularly cases with no symptoms, where you actually need a test to detect such an infection. Yes, so those are just some of the reasons that that we hypothesize for the African situation.
Very interesting. All right. You ready to do some thoroughly unscientific epidemiology with our callers?
Yes,
and
please.
Hear where they think they got COVID in the last month. We'll start with Juan in Queens. Juan, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, how are you? How's it going?
Good. How about you?
So my wife, it's my wife actually, she caught it the day, well, we found out she caught it the day before Thanksgiving. And what was interesting was my son's girlfriend, who's 24, she's always in our house, and they study together because they're both taking college classes. She wasn't feeling well. She had a fever, and she wanted to get tested. So my wife took her. She was adamant about not getting tested, and I said, listen, if you're going to be with her, if she's positive, you're positive. And it turned out they both were positive. And interestingly, though, no one else in the household caught it. I got tested twice since then, and I've been negative. So it's a little confusing for us.
That's so interesting. Juan, and that by itself, Dr. Elsader, is an interesting story. A, not everybody who's exposed in the same household gets it. I've heard that before from people. And B, here's a story about your bubbles, right? And we don't know what kinds of lifestyle their son and his girlfriend, who are in their 20s, were living, and then the parents are exposed.
Yes, and I think obviously another important thing to keep in mind is if you have any symptoms, I think people should not come together with anyone else. So having any symptoms should prompt the person to please stay at home and go get tested. I think that's the most, that's very important lesson from the what you just the scenario that you just described. I think also just to build on the issue of transmission within households or people who live together, and this is maybe a more scientific survey, but the city itself did a survey where they asked contacts and where they thought they got those who got infected, where they thought they got the infection from, and the largest proportion was from the household, from people that they were living together with.
So somebody had to bring it into the household from doing something outside.
Right, right. And then it's transmitted within the household thereafter, people that live together.
Zainab on Staten Island. Zainab, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi, a long-time listener. So I actually developed COVID on the 13th of November, and I tend to suspect, and I got tested on the 14th, and so it came back positive a couple of days later. I tend to suspect that, you know, I got it at work. Even though I'm an office worker, I do have some exposure to some of the individuals that I work with. And the thing that surprises me is that I was a poster girl for adherence to all the restrictions. I mean, I was like compulsive about it. I was wearing 3 masks. I was washing my hands compulsively. And on top of that, I was actually restricting. I mean, my movements were extremely circumscribed with exceptional work. I wasn't doing anything, and yet I ended up getting it. But I just have a question for Dr. Sutter. There's a discrepancy in terms of the CDC guidelines post-COVID recovery and what the doctors are saying. The CDC says very specifically that when individuals are recovering, they should not get tested because there's a possibility that there might be some residual virus that is going to result in a positive test, even though the person does not have the capacity for transmission. When you talk to like an individual doctor, they say that you should get tested. I've been in isolation for 24 days now.
Wow.
I am petrified. I haven't come out of my room. I am experiencing a lot of anxiety. My symptoms have abated for the most part. But, you know, right now, the major impediment to my emergence from my room, which also obviously has psychological implications, you can well imagine the solitude, the isolation and everything. What does one do? Does one get tested? Because if there's residual virus, as the CDC is saying, and is saying don't get tested because you're going to get a positive test, but you're not going to be transmitting, could you please, I would appreciate any feedback, Dr. Sutter.
And Zainab, have you continued to test positive toward your 24 days?
I have not been tested since then. I was tested initially when I had developed some vague symptoms.
Yeah, I see. Yes, because you're concerned about the result and the CDC guidelines. Yeah. So can you help her, Dr. El-Sadr, briefly?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's recommended not after a positive test, not to get retested again for the subsequent 3 months, 90 days or so. And the reason is exactly what you said, is the test can be positive because it's picking up remnants of small pieces of the virus or dead virus, for example. And therefore, we don't recommend that people who've been diagnosed to be retested again for the 3 months duration after the diagnosis. So I think we need to disseminate this information widely so physicians are able to advise their patients of this information.
So if Zainab's symptoms have abated, as she said, does she need to keep isolating after 24 days, or can she go back into the world?
She can go back into the world. If symptoms have abated, I think you do not need to get retested, and you can go back into the world. But, of course, remember, you, of course, have to practice all the protective measures that you did previously.
And you hear how she said she was so obsessive about practicing protective measures, but she had to come in close contact with some people in the course of her job, she said, so she assumes she got it from there. I guess that's an indication of, even being so careful, how much risk is out there.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we found that in the workplace, while people are careful during working hours in the distancing and the masking and so on, sometimes they let their guard down. I'm not saying that that's what you did, but they let their guard down during breaks or during lunch breaks where they congregate in a break room or and then, of course, that's when they have to pull their masks down and again in order to eat and drink and so on. So we are very much focused on the importance of consistency. And if you are going to be with someone in the same space, then please do observe the distancing. That's very vital, and try to keep the removal of the mask at minimum.
Teresa in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, good morning, Brian. I'm a longtime listener and a monthly sustainer. I have an elderly friend with severe pre-existing conditions. He never left the house. He had three family members taking care of him. He had to go into the hospital for a procedure unrelated to COVID, and he got COVID and is now in the hospital, and his three family members all tested negative. So they did not bring it in the house, so they believe he got it from the hospital procedure. Thank you so much. I'll listen the rest offline. Thank you.
Teresa, thank you very much. We have a few callers. I'm not going to go to the other ones because it would be a similar story, but a few who think they got it when they went out for routine medical procedures. Do you think that's happening, doctor?
Well, I certainly hope that it's not. I think there's, as you're well aware, there's screening, of course, of all healthcare workers daily. A symptom check to make sure that if anybody has a symptom, they're not allowed into the facility. There's also many health facilities are doing a frequent testing of their staff. And there's also a very much of an effort to make sure that people, again, are distancing and wearing masking and also wearing face shields if they're providing additional face shield to the mask if they're providing patient care. So with all these measures, one would hope that there would be minimum risk of transmission to an individual patient. But nonetheless, we know that we can minimize the transmission, but it's very hard to say that it can be zero risk. We can decrease the risk as much as we can through trying very hard to adhere to all these measures, but it's very hard to say that the risk can be zero risk.
Some great information from our guest, Dr. Wafa El-Sadr, epidemiology and global health professor at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University and director of their ICAP Center, which works on public health around the world. Dr. El-Sadr, thank you so much for the information today and for being so thoughtful with our callers. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.